Okay, I first should apologize that there will be considerable overlap with what Matt had said yesterday. And I think I sort of ended up giving this talk because Ewald Puchwein, who was supposed to give that talk, his wife is expecting a second child in 3 weeks' time, and they sort of tried to fly to Germany with the last airline that takes them, so he couldn't be here to give the talk himself. I should also mention that most of the work he has done in collaboration with a lot of people. James Bowden is a former student of mine, now a lecturer in Nottingham, who's worked a lot on the thermal history on the observational side. We're lucky enough to have George Becker as a Kavli Fellow. Alberto Rora is now a postdoc, and this is a variety of other people who have contributed to that. I think this is a picture of Ewald, and if you had hoped to see him here, I'm afraid you will have to make up with me giving the talk instead of him. And I will shift part of the blame of the talks on him, because he actually sent me a few slides that were not enough to cover 45-minute talks. But nevertheless, and especially as the conclusions, I have basically left unchanged. Even so, I'm not completely agree. It will come maybe later clear why. I should have said in the beginning that I've advised Ewald to take it a bit easy to work on the blazer heating till he has a permanent position, and apologize to his collaborators if he wasn't as responsive while he was in Cambridge than he was before. But I'm getting more optimistic again about blazer heating, as you will see in the end. This is the one-page summary about what the standard picture is, how temperature and density should relate after reionization. And this if you would just take hydrogen into account, and you would start off with after photonization, that you heat all the gas independent of density to the same temperature, and afterwards it evolves into this shape. And this is on this side because we had a little bit of a discussion yesterday about this, because photoheating balances adiabatic cooling, so you slowly get into what you may call an asymptotic equilibrium. Then there's here some shock-heated gas that depends on how much you have, is on the physics that you have in. You could either have just shocks that are due to the gravitational collapse, but you could have also shocks due to heavy AGN feedback, in which case you would have more hot gas up here. In this case here, you have photoheating versus line cooling, and that gives you another equilibrium sequence here. So with the Lyme alpha force, so with the IgM, you're mostly probing here the regime of the slightly underdense to the moderately overdense regime. And there you have something what's called a power law temperature density relation, that standard picture that goes from isothermal immediately after reionization and then steepens to a power law that's somewhere between 1 and 1.6. And at late times, it's pretty close to this 1.6. So this is the standard picture. That gets a bit more complicated if you worry about helium, and I think that's Matt discussed quite a bit too. This here is from a very nice simulation of what happens if you let a quasar produce an ionization front that is proceeding in a medium that's only partially ionized before. Then helium can, close to the quasar, can heat the gas to very high temperatures, but depending if there was already hydrogen ionized, the gas will be lower, because in this case you won't be able to ionize hydrogen again, and this is these cooler patches in this region out, so there was nothing ionized yet. So helium is a complication that comes in that is very difficult to model, and I think Matt had a very nice paper on this now quite a few years ago, and this is just numerically very challenging to get exactly right. So if we sum that up, what you expect for the evolution of the temperature, let's say at mean density as a function of redshift, high redshift here, low redshift here, you expect something like a first peak whenever hydrogen reionization happens. Then you probably would have a second peak to do the second stage of helium reionization. The first stage of helium reionization would happen together with the hydrogen, and this is a process that are relevant here. And before this, I think Matt had discussed how you latch onto that from very high redshift. So this is the background onto which we study the IgM. Then I want to say a few more words about the actual measurements of these temperatures. And so the classic method was trying to fit the widths of the absorption features in the Lyme alpha forest. The problem with this is that the width is only partially due to temperature, and partially is just due to the random motions of the gas or the more regular motion due to the Hubble flow. So whatever you do is you have to sort of take into account for this, and that's where the numerical simulations come in, where you try to sort of separate out the thermal part in sort of the width of the features that you see in absorption there. I think a while back, George Becker has put a lot of effort to do that as well as he thinks possible, and he devised sort of a method how we look at these absorption features by just measuring sort of how smooth these are, and he basically just invented a statistical measure where you just take the second derivative of in a certain flux range where you do this. And as I said, there's a range of things, and this was his new method. And the other thing what was new is that he carefully paid attention at which density or relative density to the mean you actually measure that temperature. So in this way, he sort of applied that to a large sample of absorption spectra. And this is actually a major observational effort. So this he has been lucky enough to be having been Wohl Sargent's student. So he inherited a very large sample of high resolution quasar spectra that Wohl sort of had, with his access to a Keck, had assembled. And each of these spectra that you see here is sort of a night or so at Keck. So this is not a cheap exercise to do. You need a lot of large telescope time to do this. So this is a sample used. This is sort of examples of the modeling of the spectra we do. There's always one observed and one model spectra here. And we sort of took a lot of care to sort of take all the artifacts into account and really compare them one to one. And this is a list of all spectra that George used for that effort. And this is sort of the culmination of this effort that you had seen yesterday, where a lot of work went into to actually measure now the temperature. And sort of what really sort of brought things quite a bit forward is that George looked carefully at which overdensity actually statistically weighted you have measured this temperature at the different redshifts. And as the universe sort of expands and the overall density decreases, with the absorption features, you're actually probing deeper and deeper into higher density regions slowly. So while at very high redshift, you probe around the mean, this delta is the density relative to the mean. As you go to lower redshift, you start to go into collapse structures. And as you go to even lower redshifts, you probe even further into the halos. What that means for the blazar heating is that as you go to lower redshift, you are probably more free to do what you want, because with the Lyme alpha force, you actually don't probe any more the regions that are sort of most sensitive to the blazar heating. So you can now take this measurement to try to compare to the theoretical curves, because this is now measured at a different density at each redshift. You have to assume something about how you get to mean density, and there you sort of take this assumption that there is actually a power law relation, and for different power laws, this translates into different shapes of what the temperature, the mean density would have done. So obviously, if I take an isothermal distribution, I just have this curve. But if I take a power law where the temperature actually becomes lower, where the density becomes lower as you go to closer to the mean, then this peak is sort of dipped down a little bit. And depending on what power law I take, I get a less pronounced peak or a more pronounced peak. Or for isothermal, I would have just this measurement as it is. So this is sort of where we stand and sort of
One question. If you have a distribution of temperatures at any given density, which temperatures
correspond to the mode, the mean? If you look at Ewald's papers that I quote later, you can look sort of what the differences are. The differences are noticeable but moderate. And different people have done different things. But sort of Ewald took care to sort of show you all how the different ways of averaging too. But this relation is actually quite tight. So it actually doesn't make a hell lot of a difference. So what I thought I'd do now, and because Ewald didn't give me that many slides, I went back to one of my old talks. And in 2011, when that came out, I gave a talk at a meeting where Simon White and Carlos Frink sort of celebrated their 60th birthday. And as they sort of discussed this, and the main point that I discussed were what we had yesterday was the problems with the flux PDF. And that goes back to a paper of James Bolton, a former graduate student of mine, as I said, now a lecturer in Nottingham. And what we did is we sort of, at that time, Tae-Sung Kim was a postdoc in Cambridge as well. We looked at the flux PDF in quite some detail. And at that time, sort of the simulation started to get better. And sort of when we tried to compare the simulation to the flux PDF, it just doesn't really fit. And sort of we did sit on that result for quite a while because we sort of thought that sort of puts into question the whole use of the Lyme alpha forest for quantitative work. And sort of the main thing that really bothered us was this little bit here. So what's plotted here is a cumulative flux distribution, sort of the differential flux distribution, that how many pixels you have a given flux as a function of flux level. So flux level of 1 is no absorption, flux level of 0 is full absorbed. And what really bothered me most was this discrepancy here. So while the observed spectra seem to have a lot of regions where there's no absorption, there seem to be some absorption in the spectra everywhere. And Tae-Sung Kim, who is an observer, always said, looking at these spectra, they don't really look like the observed spectra. There's some absorption everywhere. So we discussed forever if that is due to continuum fitting, because obviously in an observed spectrum, you have to sort of set the continuum level because you have a complicated quasar spectrum. Tae-Sung, and also sort of more worryingly to me, Bob Carswell, who I respect a lot, they said there's no way that we're sort of fitting that out with a continuum. And that's the reason we actually came out with this result and actually showed that's different. What we also realized is that if I want to have less absorption, sort of at low density, what that corresponds to, you have to make the gas hotter. So we said, so what we did is said sort of, okay, let's be bold. Forget about these simulations, just change the heating rate by hand, make some density dependence, and come up with something else and see what fits. So we started now to sort of play with the heating rate and just sort of empirically try to see what would fit that PDF. So this was a standard picture that you would have seen. Here we had just cranked up the heating rate and the low densities to basically invert the temperature density relation. And this was maybe in retrospect a little bit bold because we had no physical model for this whatsoever. We just did that to sort of to see what fits. And because the recombination coefficient is temperature dependent like this, if I make the low density gas hotter, there will be less absorption. And then no wonder if you sort of have this as a parameter to play with, you can actually fit this point after a while, and the rest then seem to fit better too.
Because it had only one participant for the last 30 minutes.
Thank you very much. So this is how this how this PDF problem came about. And at the end of the paper, we wrote sort of as a caveat, finally, we must also not lose sight of the possibility that other processes may contribute to the heating of the IgM. And we were fully aware that it's difficult to heat the voids. And before we really sat on that paper for a year, and we really didn't come up with an idea how really makes the voids that hot, and we came with this rather weak statement out at the end. Then, to our surprise, these papers came out, and suddenly someone came up with a sort of a method that would actually heat the voids. And we have seen that yesterday. I think it explained in quite some detail why that is sort of leads to volumetric heating and why that could easily exceed the photoheating if you make reasonable assumptions about how these blazer scale with a normal AGN population and that a certain fraction of the energy actually goes into this plasma instabilities and heats the IgM. Sort of this certainly does a job, but does it do it quantitatively? And how does it fit with the standard picture that seem to sort of fit a lot, but not all? And sort of I will discuss that now in some detail in the rest of the talk. So what the blazer heating does is that it preferentially heats the voids because there's less material, you dump the same energy again, and you don't really get an inverted temperature density relation of the kind that we did phenomenologically, but you get an upturn at low densities. And at rather low densities, and that will be important later, because where that upturn happens, there's actually not that much probing of the Lyme alpha forest anymore. So you get something, a standard relation, and then an upturn here. And sort of Ewald was the one who was writing, or was leading the papers of the group who's doing this. And they pointed out that in this way, you could get a nice rise towards lower redshift. And there was obviously some freedom in the interpretation because of sort of relating from where it was measured to the density where it actually is plotted here. And they also showed that it would improve the PDF quite a bit. And in the talks that I gave, I sort of gave sort of a measured assessment of this that looks promising, but said that would lead quite a bit of further work to actually convince both the Blazor community and the IGM community that that's important. And a lot of this has happened, is happening, and we have seen in the talks yesterday. So sort of this was sort of how I got into this, or the people I worked got into this, and I will do now sort of tell a little bit more about what happened since. This is sort of the question we started discussing yesterday, and you will have noticed that I sort of stayed conspicuously quiet because I sort of didn't want to give my talk during the discussion yesterday, but I will give now sort of my take on how seriously you should take these discrepancies of the PDF. So we were fully aware when we wrote the papers that the PDF is very sensitive at this point, and I think this is still the most critical sort of discrepancy, that it's very sensitive to the continuum placement. I had pressed several observers to sort of give their take on this, and the reason why we in the end came out of this is because the observers I sort of put a lot of trust in didn't budge and said, we're not placing the continuum that much too low, we're not fitting that all out. Then other people looked into that too. This was a paper that made that point explicitly and suggested that that might be a problem. I think we didn't disagree, it's just a question at what level. Then there was a similar paper that then also pointed out that there's a lot of sort of Poisson noise in the distribution of the measured PDF. With that, we agree too, we're aware of that too. We have worked with this sample for a while. That's the reason why I never sort of put that much effort, emphasis to the discrepancy in this part of the spectrum. A, that are relatively few pixels. This is a PDF, this is logarithmic. So this is relatively few pixels. And B, there are large variations. What I was always more worried was about the sort of this last point, or the last 2 points in this distribution, that there's sort of some absorption everywhere in the simulated spectra that the observed spectra don't seem to show, and that we sort of explain with a hot gas. This is sort of, to me, a slightly secondary part of it. Obviously, you want to fit that too, and you will be able to do that better. But there is a lot of variance, as these people point out explicitly. So now sort of will come the talks that sort of makes actually sort of the case for Blazor heating a bit more difficult. So there were a series of papers that sort of showed that the standard picture actually works quite well. But for the people who are keen on Blazor heating, I think I have sort of a positive message at the very end too. So don't get too upset in the next 10 minutes or so. So sort of the next thing that happened is that people went back to the Doppler parameter fitting. This isn't particularly popular with observers because this is a real tedious effort to do. So you take the spectrum, you continuum fit it, and then you sit down and you just fit the lines line by line by hand. You can, if you talk to Tayson Kim about it, she gives you an earful about how tedious this is. Luckily, Chuck Steidel had a grad student who sort of couldn't really say no to that task. And sort of she went back and actually did a very careful analysis of a very nice set of spectra too. And what's different with this is that Chuck is sort of one of the people who have sort of lots of data in this too. And they actually compiled a sample of spectra where you had a lot of spectra in the same redshift range. So if you look at this sample here, they all sort of cover the same redshift range, and Gwen Rudy in her thesis sort of did painstakingly fit all these spectra because she had to do so for other parts of her thesis project anyway. And so they wrote a paper what that means for the Lyman Alpha Forest 2. This resulted in this very nice compilation of Doppler parameters, and the way observers like to plot this is that they plot the column density of the line, what is sort of the strength of the absorption system, against the width of the line, what's basically just fitting a Gaussian to the line and sort of characterizing the width by Doppler width. And this is sort of compared to what you had before, where a sample like this would be only where a plot like this would be only sparsely sampled. This is actually a spectacularly well sampled BN diagram from lines all at the same redshift. That sort of takes care of the problem that there might be some evolution with redshift in this too. So what you can do then now with a diagram with this is you can try to dig out the temperature. As I said, it's only part of the width in this Doppler parameter fitting that's thermal. So what people try to do is that they try to fit a lower cutoff to these lines, and this is not as bad as it is because there are lots of points overplotted here. So there's sort of a reasonable well-characterized cutoff, and this temperature density relation relates into a sort of slope of this Doppler parameter as a function of density, of column density, because the column density is correlated with the density of the gas quite closely as well. So that's what they did. So sort of this is a different plot of this. They took the weaker lines out. They found statistical ways of plotting these lower cutoff, and they have a bit less points plotted here so that you actually can see where the cutoff is. So what that gave, if you sort of calibrate that with numerical simulation to get from a column density to a density, is a temperature density relation that gives you a large gamma, what means a relatively steep slope. So no sign of this kind of inverted temperature density relation in the PDF that we naively had sort of fitted before. So sort of we obviously looked at that paper very carefully. We weren't quite happy with the way they had done it, but we were very impressed by the data set, so we decided to reanalyze this data set. And it was done in a paper by James Bolton 2 years ago now. And sort of we took our simulations and just reanalyzed that, did the fitting ourselves. We couldn't get around the fact that we got the same gamma more or less within the errors. We sort of underestimated the errors a little bit, but there was no sort of a way of sort of trying to fit something what has a temperature density relation like this. This just doesn't fit the data at all. So there is a gamma that sort of is a rising temperature that corresponds to a rising temperature with rising density. We noted, however, that they sort of took an outdated calibration of the relation of column density to density. So the actual temperature they infer is off by quite a bit. I don't know why they did this. I think I even talked to Quinn Rudy about this before they actually submitted the paper. They sort of went ahead anyway. But they took a wrong calibration of how you get from temperature to column density. This sort of translates into a wrong temperature. And they quoted in the paper actually temperatures that was a factor of 2 off. This is actually important, as I will show in a second, because we put that now into that plot. And as you sort of will remember from what I said before, you can actually get from this plot to a temperature at mean density as a function of redshift if you know the gamma. If we plotted Gwen Rudy's point on there, it just didn't make sense. Sort of there seemed to be a large contradiction. For this gamma, the temperature was completely off. After we sort of calibrated it properly, it fell bang on where it should fell for this gamma, where the temperature should be for this gamma. So we thought, okay, now really things are fitting together. So we measure the gamma, we measure the temperature, we measure now the temperature even at 2 densities in a way in this way, and that fits together very nicely. So now you really have the falling temperature density relation as you would expect in the standard model, where photoheating balances adiabatic cooling quite a bit after ionization. So this didn't look very good for having sort of an inverted temperature density relation. We also looked at the PDF, and as we sort of now swung into the other direction and sort of didn't believe anymore necessarily that there is a problem with the PDF, I think we became a bit more sort of happy to disregard that the observer sort of said that it gets a continuum fitting right and made larger continuum corrections. And if you do this, you sort of can fit it, but sort of it's sort of continuum corrections so observers are not really happy with. And this here is a plot that shows that with these last points, what densities you probe, and it's sort of it's more mildly under dense regions where you get to with the last point here. Now a little bit more on the modeling, and this is sort of where Ewald probably would have spent most of his talk on, because that's where he spends most of his effort in. And so I give you a summary how that has evolved with time too. So if you do this kind of numerical simulations, you have to make some assumption about the photoionization rates. And normally what people do is that they use a model that sort of tries to do that in 1D with a one-dimensional differential equation, Hadamard-Dow, that assumes some QSOs at late times that do the helium reionization, some galaxies at early times that do the hydrogen reionization, and that fits sort of the mean flux level in the spectra very well, and the inferred photonization rates as well. So Ewald puts that into one of these Hydro codes, runs these simulations, and as he's very careful, looked in lots of the different effects. And here I actually have the plot in between mode, median, and mean that you just ask for in this paper. And also what sort of has been in the early simulation often been done wrongly is that people sort of used an equilibrium solver instead of a non-equilibrium solver. This makes a difference too. That flattens the relation a bit, and that sort of even gives a slight flattening as you go to lower densities if you do this. The reason you have to do this is that if in equilibrium, if you do that with the equilibrium solver doing helium reionization, you always have slightly the different both reionization processes, you have slightly the wrong neutral fractions, and that gives you wrong heating rates, and that gives you sort of an underestimate of the temperature at all points. So how does that fare if I compare these simple simulations where it's just assume a homogeneous UV background to the measured temperatures? And Matt, if we would have time, would have told you that's not something you should do. You really have to take the inhomogeneity into account, but we did nevertheless and looked sort of how that works, and sort of Ewald has sort of built up here how that changes if you take the different UV backgrounds. And this is sort of an equilibrium, an older UV background model, that's a new one. If you take a non-equilibrium solver, you get nicely in the helium, the input due to helium reionization. The data has now shifted a little bit. So if you take Hadamard-Dow, it happens a bit late. If you look at some inconsistency in Hadamard-Dow, you would get this curve here. And so by and large, given that this is sort of still a good way of doing helium reionization, that fits remarkably well. So the quasars seem to have an emissivity that comes up just at the right time to do helium reionization where you have a peak like this. So this sort of makes it much less attractive to sort of invoke a different heating process completely. That sort of starts off orders of magnitude different in terms of the original energy input, and then fine-tune it to get something to a level of a factor of 2, exactly the same heating rate to do that at the same time. I think these kind of things happen, but sort of in principle, it looks as if there's relatively little need to do this. There's a very nice explanation why you should have this rise. I will come to the more positive interpretation of this at the very end. So this sort of summarizes a standard picture, sort of different times where you reionize the effect of the non-equilibrium. You have sort of an early peak of hydrogen reionization, and that might not be quite right either, because sort of that's inhomogeneous too, and you get more energy in. So in places that might be higher, something Matt didn't have time to discuss as well. This has to be done with individual helium-2 regions too. But by and large, modularly, how well we can model this, that seems to actually fit quite well. And I tried to convince you sort of that the PDF and the gamma might have gone away too. So the last 50 minutes, I will actually talk about things that are not published and give you sort of maybe a slightly more positive take on things too. Before I come to the more positive observationals, one thing is we have run now larger simulations too. So this is something where Jamie Bowden was PI on, and James and Ewald and Deborah Sijacki have sort of put a lot of effort too. So sort of as we're working in that field now for quite a while, we find it relatively easy now to get computing time too. And so we have moved to larger simulations as well to see, sort of take out the last doubts that you may have, just because sort of the simulations are still sort of insufficient in terms of computational resources. So this is sort of a large suite of simulations where we sort of have put in everything we knew about the problem about 2 years ago, and we sort of went into that and sort of see how well we can actually simulate this. We have run a number of thermal histories in that as well, but sort of one we have picked to basically fit all the data. And sort of this is done by construction, by just adjusting the heating rate. But this is a simulation that really is now consistent with the measurement of the data, and that gives you the gamma that you want to. And this is sort of the equivalent BN diagram to the one of Rudy et al. And sort of, as you see, that really looks very similar too. And the cutoff from Rudy said we fit to the data, fits the simulations in the Doppler parameter very well. If you look actually at the collapse distribution of Doppler parameters for a certain column density range, there's really very little of a discrepancy left. So this peak fits the Doppler parameter very well. So there seem to be sort of everything consistent with the new continuum corrections that Jamie applies. We fit the PDF very well too. That's shown here. There's still slight discrepancies, but sort of in principle, you can make that work quite nicely. So this is sort of a standard picture and sort of modular how well you can do that. That seems to actually fit quite well. What what still doesn't work and where there's still room to sort of put something in, I will do in the last minutes. So if you look very carefully, we still don't get quantitatively the helium peak exactly right. I would argue that sort of helium ionization is more complicated than what we did there. Ewald, who likes to take the positive view on blazer heating, points out that there's discrepancy, particularly at the low redshift ends, and there's some excess heating here. So there you can start to put some extra heat in if you want to. And as you go to lower redshift, you have more freedom anyway because sort of the constraints from the Lyman alpha force will get weaker and weaker because you're probing higher and higher density and you're pushing your energy into the low density regions. So if you put your sort of energy into a sort of slightly lower redshift, then you're actually perfectly fine and can put quite a lot of energy in there. This is sort of what you see here. At the lowest redshift, you're already at an overdensity of 5. This will further rise as you go to even lower redshifts. The data will get worse, so you will don't even probe to the same overdensity that you do with this very high quality, high resolution spectra. Then having said that the temperature looks very promising to explain with helium ionization, when you actually look at the helium opacities, they are really awful, and they don't really fit at all. So sort of this is from a large sample of a paper that Gabor Wozek put out 2 years ago. I think I checked. He hasn't even put the revised version on as to pH yet. So he obviously has severe trouble with the referee. Yeah. But
it probably is out now.
It's out now. Okay. Matt is a co-author. I think Mike Scholl is probably is sort of the other player in this, and I know that he wasn't very happy. But that I just say sort of that measuring these opacities in helium is nothing like measuring the opacities in hydrogen. But nevertheless, you don't actually get anything like the curves like observed. So sort of the helium sort of doesn't seem to rise up as quickly beyond the peak as it should. It seems to stay flat. What may indicate earlier ionization may indicate problems with the data. But it sort of it slightly makes you uneasy to sort of take the temperature peak at face while you're knowing that there's still a problem with actually fitting the opacities. And this is sort of taking the positive view in terms of for this workshop. What's the other thing is what's new is and what sort of Matt hasn't seen either, I think, is that we have sort of revisited the PDF. And the evidence for hot gas at low densities just doesn't go away. So sort of this revisiting of the PDF is, in this case, one single spectrum. But it is really the best spectrum ever taken. So what we did for a while, and Stefano Cristiani is a PI on this, is apply for time to get a very, very high signal-to-noise spectrum. So we took a very bright quasar that already had quite a bit of observation before and ask for another 40 hours on this. And that brings you to signal-to-noise in the Lyme-alpha forest of 300. So this is a part of the spectrum, and red thinks that the first author on this, Alberto Rorai, who is a postdoc with George Becker and me, has taken out because they're contaminated by metal lines. But this is now a spectrum of incredible quality where the continuum fitting should be sort of be a piece of cake, and where sort of the observers are even more convinced that they won't get that wrong. So Alberto is sort of likes to play with statistical methods too, and he sort of has now done quite a bit to do the analysis different. He sort of stretched the PDF in the low density regions to get more weights there and things like this. But I sort of just give you that's the look why this PDF looks here a bit different. So this is now not the flux level, but it's a flux level that's sort of rescaled in a certain way to stretch out the flux levels around one. But there's no doubt that in this spectrum that the standard gamma with sort of 1.6 doesn't fit the data, neither at the high flux levels, but not there here either, while both an isothermal or inverted density relation seem to fit much better. We also sort of realized that maybe just pushing the whole density relation just into a different slope without a physical model is not the right thing to do. So Alberto has sort of used now a lot of different parameterizations to see what could actually fit and reprocess simulations to sort of quantify this. So he used models with a broken power law that I will show in the next two slides. He used models where you have temperature fluctuations on certain scales, where you have hot regions intermixed with cold regions. And the result is actually always the same, and I will just show the one for the sort of with a broken power law. So he just made a model sort of where now the temperature density relation is falling up to a certain overdensity, which is close to the mean, and then it's rising again with a different power law slope. And there's some models shown here like this, and these are where the break is just at the mean density. So up to mean density, it's falling. Below mean density, it's actually rising again. And you see that sort of, it doesn't really matter what you do in this regime. What's nice, because we have already sort of established that the temperature density relation should be standard there. But as you go to sort of below the mean density, you want to have it at least isothermal or maybe even rising. And he has quantified this, and if these look a bit wrecked, it means that he hasn't sort of sampled the parameter space because it's relatively expensive too finely. But as I go to an overdensity of 2, I can actually have a nicely rising in the upper densities, and sort of an inverted, or if you sort of go to the upper end of these 1-sigma contours, maybe an isothermal temperature density relation. If I make my sort of breakpoint too low, then I have to sort of make my whole temperature density relation rising to fit the data, because otherwise what I really need is that the gas density below the mean is at least as hot or hotter than the gas at above the mean density. So if I pick the break wrongly, then I have just to sort of invert the whole temperature density relation, because that's then the only way to sort of get the gas hot at the temperatures where I still probe it at these sort of low flux levels. This looks sort of remarkably like what you actually get, falling and then rising. You still have the problem that you really have to fine tune your heating rates now. Because the helium photoheating you will not get around. I don't think we got that completely wrong, and there's maybe it's a factor of 50% level room for fitting something else in. But you really have to fine tune your blazer heating that it sort of just fits in there and does it together with the helium heating. But if you really want to do that, you can do this. Alternatively, you can just push it to a bit lower redshift, and there won't be that much constraint from the Lyme alpha forest.
What redshift is the blazer?
3. So this is the summary and conclusions as Ewald has written them. So he sort of points out the discrepancy between the temperatures predicted from the photoheating measure temperatures have come down. He says the TEV places may heat the low density, It's still challenging to measure because the Lyman alpha force is more sensitive to higher density. And you may actually further improve the agreement that's there if you fine tune your model so that it just does arrest what the helium heating doesn't do. He also points out that continuum correction is still an issue. And with this, he meant that you have to take the inhomogeneity as account in both in hydrogen helium, hydrogen ionization, helium ionization to actually do the model prediction right. And that's what he has done in his Puchwein et al. 2015 paper. In this sense, is an approximation too that fits astonishingly well, but it's not quite obvious why it fits as well as it actually does. And this is what I had to say.
So, right on time. We have time for questions.
It's what in your conclusion, on one hand, you say a laser heating may help. On the other, you say it's very difficult to detect because then it will not affect the high density. These two don't seem to me that
don't
piece together, right?
No, the reason why I will not dismiss it out of hand is because if this is not done by blazer heating, it has to be done by something else. I think this is a solid observational result. You need the hot gas. This hot gas, we have no feedback simulation yet that comes anywhere close to doing this. Heating the voids is difficult. This is a mechanism that does it.
The but heat. You say that will not affect your PDF anyway.
No, it does, but it affects it in this little last little point. Okay.
Then there is a way to.
There is a way, yeah. Okay. There is a way, yeah. And you will be able. You will not be able to do that much better with a 10-meter telescope because you will not convince the TAC to give you many of these extremely ultra signal to noise spectra. But once you have a larger telescope, that will become more routine to have spectra at this quality. So with a 30 meter telescope, people will still take absorption line spectra. So you will have more of these. Alternatively, what you can do is you can take the less quality spectra of which there are a lot and improve this measurement as well. So I think there is room for improving the measurements. There is a sign that there's something. Either we see some feedback here, what we haven't modeled yet, right? Maybe it's the blazer heating. I don't know. As I said, I've have gone through oscillations through this. I was quite excited in 2011 and thought now we finally have a model that may do it. Let's have a closer look. Then all the evidence went the other way for quite a while. This is the latest we have done. I've oscillated on if you can fit that away with continuum fitting. And after this, I don't think so anymore.
So just considering this plot, then I don't see any error bar there. There's an error bar too small to be plotted. Because otherwise, when you do the fitting, right? You introduce a new parameter, then of course that gives you benefit. But whether that's required, that depends on your error.
Okay. Look, this is one spectrum. So formally the error bars are small. But then you have to make a model what you think the error bars for sample variance are, and that's again the reason why I think this is less important than this.
Well, yeah. That's again statistically you have to take in an error bar and see whether there's a new parameters that we require.
Yeah, but as you may know, getting really quantitative error bars is difficult.
But if we cannot do that, then we cannot really make a statement.
I gave you my take on it, that the error bars are not large enough to get rid of this. However I try to model the errors on this, I would be less sure.
Yeah. So you're saying that sample variance mostly affects the transmission around 0.2 to 0.4, but not at around 1?
Yeah, because this is much stronger absorbers, and that's much less of the spectrum. So this is sort of, as you see, this is less points, and this is sort of, this is now smeared out the point that you had seen. That was before this peak, and by the rescaling, this is just broadened to make it look a bit nicer so that you sample the peak with 3 points instead of one. This is more points, and that's where you have lots of absorbers, and that are the ones that are easier to model too. This is more problematic for many reasons.
So two questions in reverse order. So first, you were talking about the helium opacity. Mm-hmm. You showed this picture with a lot of data points in a line that didn't go through the data points, and then remarked on the shape of the line. I didn't fully understand that. So what's
plotted here is the effective optical depths. Mm-hmm. So this is how opaque helium is, sort of before helium is ionized, this should be very large. In these models, helium is ionized between redshift 4 and 3, so this should shoot up between 3 and 4. It can shoot up at different levels, and Matt is the expert on this, and he has models that are a little bit, that more go like this, but none of the models is as flat like this.
So is it just
said that this data is no comparison to the hydrogen data. If you ever have looked at this data, this is full of artifacts that basically don't know where the zero level is. It is very heroic to put any points from the data onto this plot.
So it should come with enormous systematic error bars, which...
The people who do the work say we have done that properly, that's all fine. It might mean that helium realization is earlier. It's not obvious what will give there in the end.
So,
Matt, you want to comment? You're a co-author.
I agree that it's really hard to do this analysis. But it's just becoming really the ionizing backgrounds are not uniform. They're fluctuating everywhere.
That's the other thing. That shouldn't be a line. That should be large fluctuations.
And so
the time.
Reasons why, like, so and Martin said that, like, I had calculations that also didn't extend to his high redshift. Like, they have more transmission at high redshifts than what the simulations I ran a while ago showed. But I think there are issues with this comparison, this comparison is really difficult, as Barney was saying, and I don't know if I would conclude that there's any evidence that helium realization is more extended than we think from the opacity measurements.
So you have to forgive my naivete. I see a large cluster of data points that systematically sit on one side of the theoretical curve.
But that theoretical curve is...
We shouldn't worry about it.
I mean, this is a homogeneous ionizing background model that where they had to make assumptions about the Dmitri path of helium 2 ionizing photons. And so I don't know how much... That theoretical curve is not like set in stone.
Okay.
Now, what that should probably tell you is if you want to do 2/3 of the heating with helium heating and 1/3 with laser heating, you can probably come up with a model that does it. Yeah? That you can probably squeeze in, and there's enough uncertainty both in the data and the modeling to allow for it. It's just a question, if you really want to have a model, we have 2/3 helium heating and 1/3 laser heating. Or if you rather want to have it a little bit later or not at all.
And I guess
so you can either say we don't model that well enough, and once we do inhomogeneous realization models, we sort that out all with the helium heating, or you put some blazer heating in as well. There's no doubt that heating at that level from helium heating happens. Yeah? We might not have figured out how the inhomogeneous are, but it will happen. Yeah? So it's just the distribution spatially that we can't do properly.
I have one more question, but before we do, I would like to invite Weimer to come up and set up.
Any more questions?
Go ahead.
I was wondering, we were talking about non-equilibrium situation, but do you